This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Good to hear your voice again, Nate.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Lyle, we had an incredible time here. You, Dr. Lyle, came over to the Fasting Escape a couple of days ago, and gave a talk for our guests here, for our patients, and some audience members. It was incredible. And you talked about the ego trap, the pleasure trap. So, Dr. Lyle, we want to really thank you. It was a lot of fun, and a lot of the patients here just had a great time.
Yeah, great place. People are great. Food was great. Everything was terrific.
Fantastic. And we're looking forward to having you.
Even though it's the fasting escape, there's also really good food there when you're done fasting, by the way. So excellent.
And we got to hear a little bit about Dr. Lyle's starch targets. So we'll get more about that in the fasting escape newsletter coming out. But Dr. Lyle, we had a great time. So we are going live today with, we are going through these questions today about keeping in close. What do we feel so emotional when someone in a position of authority is nice to us? We have a listener who's trying to understand what the evolutionary psychology of autism is, and a question about war and modern day activities about that. And then we've got one question about the Myers-Briggs test, if we have time. Mm-hmm. So, which I'm sure, Dr. Lyle, you can't wait to talk about the Myers-Briggs test.
I can't wait to talk about that.
I love it how fired up you get whenever we talk Myers-Briggs.
Yeah. Oh, well, what can you do?
All right. Okay, our first question. Dr. Lyle, I want to do well at university, but when I'm reading or attending lectures, my attention wanders really easily, and it's common for me to start to feel sleepy within seconds, no matter what time of the day. Does my brain find these activities completely useless? And what can I do to convince it otherwise?
First of all, I know this is a person from a faraway land, because they use the term university, and they're using it in a way that we don't use it in the U.S. So the Beat Your Genes podcast is international. All right. What's actually happening is that our person here is short of sleep. You cannot take a sleep satiated brain and make it sleepy by boredom. That's not what happens. So boredom will unmask an underlying sleep debt, and so will some other things. So for example, if you have a glass of wine, that will unmask a sleep debt. So that will cause people to go to sleep or to be sleepy. But if you are not sitting on a bunch of sleep debt and you have a glass of wine, it's not going to make you sleepy. So that's all that's really transpiring here. So that means this person is sort of living their life in a chronic, probably low grade sleep debt, like a lot of young people do. And as a result, when they get into a situation that's boring, it's unmasking that sleep debt. Same thing is true with food. So food will, if you eat, it'll perk you up a little bit. And then if you get sleepy afterwards, that's not from the digestion of the food. That is an unmasking of the sleep debt. So that's all the real situation is there. So if you want to do better at university, get to sleep on time, and then you'll be able to stay wide awake through the most boring of lectures. And then you can make all kinds of notes on a separate notebook about everything that's interesting going on in your mind while you're listening to the stupid lecture, waiting for those little jewels of what the professor may ask on an exam. So that's how you do it. So Alan Goldhammer made huge lists of everything he needed to run a fasting facility all the way through school. And I made lists and lists of all the places in the world that I wanted to visit. So I've visited more places than he's visited, and he has a more successful business than I do. And this is how we lived our lives. It was all right there evident even in the early years.
Well, let me sidetrack here. I thought that you are self-professed to be lower openness to new experience. And I made an assumption that highly open people are the ones who like to travel a lot. Is there a distortion there?
Actually, no. If you look at where I want to go, I don't want to go anywhere dangerous where there's like snakes. I've heard the water in Bali is like beautiful, but I've heard that there's like water snakes, which really freaks me out. I don't want to go anywhere where there's some bug that could bite me or some virus. So all this, or some government that's so weird about how they do things that they could throw me in jail, or thieves that would, you know, leave me dead with a knife in my gut in the back of an alley for a few hundred dollars. No, none of these places interest me. So I'm not. So I'm interested in not.
When you put it that way,
starts to narrow it down. So I've seen Sigmund Freud's office in Vienna. I've looked for Arthur Conan Doyle's office in Edinburgh, places like that. So that's how open I am, and that makes me 100 times more open than Alan, who doesn't even want to leave Northern California. So that's how that works.
Fascinating. Well, so of course, let's review for this listener's question.
Yeah.
The way to get good sleep you've reviewed before the podcast is what?
Well, I mean, it's basic. You just have to get on to sleep on time on a decent routine, and you're wanting to sleep to satiety. So there's no magic to getting enough sleep. You just simply take the time to do it, and that's what it is that you have to do. What people will do is they want to chisel it, and then they wind up, you know, that this is why a big reason why coffee is such a big hit in the world is actually because it covers up sleep debt, and so people don't feel sleepy even though they are in fact sleepy. And what sleepiness is, it's actually a chemical that is signaling that the brain is polluted and that the brain needs to be cleaned. That's effectively what's transpiring there. So you want to have a clean brain. You want to start out every day with your brain as clean as you can get. You know, you won't always do so. Adrenaline will be something that will essentially keep that feeling at bay for a long time, even though you may be very tired. So that's why if you're a student with a bunch of conscientiousness, you could be short of sleep, but you could still be wide awake listening to that lecture, running on adrenaline. Not a good way to do things. Our guy, whoever this is, doesn't have that much adrenaline. Conscientiousness is not that high. And so as a result, they've got a nice balanced life. So when they're in a boring lecture, they're starting to go to sleep. And within seconds, the brain starts saying, this isn't worth the trouble. That means that what's happening, if you're feeling sleepy, you've got a lot of sleep debt, and the boredom's unmasking it. The right thing to do is get to bed on time.
Mm-hmm. And does exercising help people get to bed on time?
Maybe. It might do so, but a lot of people just simply need to make the time. They need to have enough discipline to get enough sleep. I mean, that's just what it is. You don't necessarily need to exercise. If you're somebody that has a hard time getting to sleep and you've got a lot of nervous tension, then exercise could be useful for that. And it could be useful, obviously, just in general for general comprehensive health benefits. But the main thing is that people like to essentially borrow, you know, consume some more time today, borrowing against tomorrow. It's like a little charge card. And so they'll stay up and they'll try to chisel the day the next day and squeeze more hours in a day. Yeah, don't get greedy. You know, you get 24 hours a day, and you're going to need 7 or 8 or maybe 9 of those hours for sleep. If you chisel one of those hours, you know, it's going to cost you, and it's not worth it. You know, obviously in emergencies, it's worth chiseling it. But if you live your life perpetually chiseling it, that's a waste of time. The quality of your existence drops. The quality of your comprehension, your mental abilities are compromised, and your experience is diminished. So don't do it. Make it a regular habit that you feel good. Every animal, you know, this is the only animal on earth. It's the only one that shorts itself asleep. And it's the only one that can. We've got electric light bulbs keeping us up. We've got drugs that will keep us up and keep us functioning, even though when we've got a huge signal to tell us to go to sleep. So we're artificially pushing this brain past what is ideal for it. You know, don't do it. So do a better job of that, and you'll get better grades and feel better and enjoy your life more.
So no late night discos for you then, Dr. Lyle, right?
Never. I don't think that's happened once.
Have you pulled all nighters when you were in school studying?
Never. Never happened. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that's a total loser when it comes to actual performance on exams. So mm-hmm. that's been studied well. So you start to get into a situation where you better get at least 6 hours or you've just wasted your time. So you start to go into that sixth hour and you're just going to study a little bit more, and it's going to be compromising you very significantly on that exam. So yeah, that's a mistake to pull all-nighters. You need to be planning in advance better. Make sure that, you know, one of the most important things you can do is to try to get a really decent night's sleep in the nights before exams. That's a big deal.
I remember I pulled one all-nighter in college, and it was for some project that was due. And,
right.
And it was more of a procrastinating all-nighter because I ended up playing Risk with my roommates throughout the entire night. And then 2 hours before it was due, then I like got my act together, finished it, and then turned it in. So I was like, well,
there
that
you
was
go.
A waste of time. Yeah.
Yeah. Sterling high conscientiousness being demonstrated. All right. What else?
It's probably a psychology class. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. What's up? What else we got?
All right. Our next question. Dr. Lyle, I've been curious about the following scene. So can you share some thoughts on altruistic behavior? Specifically, when someone in authority or in an intimate relationship finally apologizes for their harsh or abusive long-term behavior, why is it that can bring a tearful or sad reaction?
I wish I knew who they were referring to, either the recipient of the apology or the person who's giving the apology. I'm assuming that they mean the recipient, but I'm not sure that that's what they mean. Because sometimes the perpetrator will do this. And sometimes it's because there has been a power shift and the perpetrator is now in some hot water. And so as a result, when they're apologizing, they they are tearful. And the tearfulness is a signal of their distress, and they're really slipping into a "I need your help" childlike position, and they're demonstrating vulnerability in hopes of being treated better in the aftermath of a potential power shift in the dynamics. So this is going to be real common with prisoners, or some perpetrator confessing a crime. And suddenly, now they're tearful, okay? Until then, they were an SOB, and abusive and nasty and sociopathic. But now suddenly, they're facing the jury or they're facing the judge, and now they're all so sorry, and they're apologizing, and they're confessing, and they're tearful, okay? So that's what they're doing is that they are shifting the relationship out of an adult-to-adult dynamic, and they're shifting it to a child-parent dynamic. So that would be one way that could happen. Now, possibly on the other side of it, if you are the receiver of this, you could feel tearful, I suppose. You could also just be pissed or disgusted. So it's not like this is some universal process that's going to take place. You could be, if you are still actually in a position of weakness with respect to the tyrant, and the tyrant is actually apologizing for God knows what CD has gone on with this tyrant. Subtle shifts in their power, who knows? So what could be happening is that the tyrant or abuser could be coming with an apology, and then what happens is that the person on the other side still feels the person's power, still feels essentially subject to the abuse potential, and now, however, is getting a signal that there's some compassion on the other side of the system. And so now they fall into an expressive childlike situation and cry and you know, are tearful and are emotional in this way, which demonstrates their vulnerability, but now they've got a higher statistical likelihood that they're going to get some mercy. They're going to get some kind of essential parental, altruism or parental concessions in a way that they were not getting these things before. So that would be, that would be a reason for that kind of a shift. So in either case, the reason why we're getting an emotional response of that nature is going to be because there's some fancy shift in the CB and the dynamics. Somebody is making a move in order to protect themselves in some fashion. And so we now slip into a childlike, I need your help, vulnerability dynamic in order to elicit essentially protection and a lack of aggression or consideration from the person on the other side. So I think that's why it is that we see what we see, no matter which side it's coming from.
Fascinating. Now, let's shift the question a little bit and assume that there is no power dynamic there. So, for example, once in a while, Dr. Lyle, you'll go on a tangent and you'll say something extremely empathetic and extremely just pleasing to hear. And once in a while, I get a little teary-eyed. Like, it's like I'm always curious why that's happening, because I'm not
right. What you're experiencing is benevolent dominance. Okay. So it's the same thing that what you're feeling is on that is you're feeling sort of if someone in some kind of a position of authority with some strength actually demonstrates that they're going to be very compassionate and very protective of somebody, then what this can do is it can cause that same kind of a reaction that now once again, instead of suddenly you feel like, hey, I don't have to sit here and fight out my situation adult to adult, I can slip into childlike mode, okay? And so when you're listening to me do something like this, you can actually, because you've got mirror neurons, you're actually imagining yourself being in the position of a person who is on the other side of this sudden strength of protection. And so as a result, you can feel what would be happening in the mind of someone who's on the other side of this kind of protective display, and you can feel that they might go slip into a childlike vulnerable mode and express their vulnerability because they need help, and that they could express that and feel a confidence that they're going to get it because of the demonstration of the powerful person on the other side that's indicating that they are coming after that situation and that they are willing to protect. So I think that's what's happening is it's resonating a mirror neuron inside of you as you put yourself in the position of a suddenly protected individual who needed help. That's what I think that is.
That's fascinating. Now, on the same reaction, that like tearful reactions and emotional reactions, I was reading in a psychology article a few months ago or so, and they were making the case, I don't remember the whole article. I didn't even read the whole thing, but it was basically talking that some people, when they hear music, that's incredibly, that it can be incredibly emotional and they can feel like shivers and they get a little tearful reaction. What's that and how is it different? You know, is it,
Yeah, I think that what you're going to find is now I have not followed up on this in many years, but 20 years ago or so, I read that some neuroscientist at Duke had figured out, or believed he had figured out, that essentially chords are eliciting emotional responses out of people because the human voice actually is speaking in chords. So a human voice is not a monotone. It's actually, if you analyze the acoustic properties of the voice is actually being spoken in chords. And apparently the nature of those chords, whether they're major, minor, diminished, or augmented, or whatever it is that they are, those are changing as the person speaks according to the emotion centers in the brain. In other words, what the person is attempting to communicate, you know, with these paralinguistic characteristics of the speech. So when a person's happy and like, hey, like that, that's going to be essentially they are speaking in a major chord. Whereas if they're upset, it's going to be in a minor chord, or they're sad and depressed. And if they are, you know, the shift of emotion that you feel with augmented or diminished chords is very interesting. You feel an incomplete tension and a kind of a concern or worriness. And so there's essentially what we're getting at is that the human voice in its acoustical properties is communicating a tremendous amount of information about the emotion of the speaker, you know, completely independent of the words. And so music itself, an orchestra, what an orchestra is it's a supernormal stimulus. So what we've done is we've taken chords and we've got like 101 strings and they're all playing, you know, these chord sequences throughout the orchestra. And it's rich and layered and it goes up from, you know, the bass all the way to the, you know, piccolo. And so you get an extremely rich, supernormal stimuli of a whole orchestra essentially communicating the emotion of a human voice. And so you can now see why music would have such powerful emotional capabilities because it's supernormal. Music itself is, I mean, just a person singing would have been the original music, but actually the original music before singing would have been speech. Okay, and before speech, all you had was noise of essentially nothing other than nonverbal communication, which would have been the expression of emotion through noise. I had one lady thought that she suspected that the saxophone was a particularly sexy instrument because it sounds like people, you know, sort of in sort of a rough, intimate, throaty like way that they would be if they were really sexually into each other, particularly a male towards a female. And so, I think that that's probably, I mean, whether or not we've got it mapped exactly the way this guy suspected that he had it mapped or whether or not it's close, I don't think it matters. I think it's clear that, that what music is it's a supernormal stimuli of the human paralinguistic cues that communicate emotion in speech and in singing. And as a result of that, it has a powerful ability to directly elicit feelings inside of people that would be essentially mirror neurons to what the emotional expression would be of the person who would be singing or talking, with words or sounds that would be being generated from the feelings that they were having at that time.
It's just fascinating. I mean, there's some songs out there that, you know, I start listening mm-hmm. to them and it's just, you can't stop until they're done. And it's just, yes. It makes your whole day afterwards.
Yeah. Like I can remember, I don't remember a lot of songs where I can remember the very first time that I heard them, I liked them. But one of them I can remember. I can remember the first time I heard Your Smiling Face by James Taylor. And the very first time I heard it, I was happy. And that's, you know, it, obviously the story and the words go along with it, but the sound is extremely positive and happy and optimistic. And it is completely consistent with what the words are in the music. And so it's a beautiful fit. And it was an instant hit with me. It just, you know, there it was. And so it reached, the music itself reaches right down into it. Also think about, if you think about some intimate syncopated slow beat of some of the beginnings of songs, it's very reminiscent of the movement of a female, okay? The sexy movement of a female walking, taking her sweet time, swaying from side to side. And so this music can definitely communicate things that people feel and essentially communicate, you know, beautifully the internal experience, and therefore cause that to be resonated in a listener.
So, Dr. Lyle, any chance that we'd ever get to see you karaoke?
Zero chance.
Maybe in Las Vegas at Chef AJ's.
Yeah. No, there. Yeah, I don't drink, and there's not enough scotch in the world to make that happen. So, no happening.
At least in your car when you're alone.
Yeah, that's a whole different story. Then I'm Frank. That's how that works.
Well, you do it your way.
You got it.
All right, Dr. Lyle, is autistic behavior or Asperger's syndrome meaningfully different from being low agreeableness and low neuroticism? The more this listener reads about high-functioning autism or Asperger's syndrome, the more it seems to sound like someone low in both of those traits.
You know, I think it's completely different. And so I think that a lot of people are probably, diagnoses in the world are there's two possibilities for diagnoses. One of it is that something true has been identified, and another thing is that it's a social contagion. And so the widespread diagnosis of Asperger's, for example, I think can get close to a social contagion. Of course, there's people that are disagreeable, stable, et cetera, and they can look like they are not particularly interested in what's going on in other people's nervous systems, and they can be a little blunt, et cetera. That's not the same thing as an Asperger's. So there's a difference. So let me kind of explain a couple things. There's a difference between something wrong with the brain and simply an interesting combination on the bell curves. So think about kidneys. There's going to be a bell curve of kidney function. So every 25-year-old that hasn't had damage to their kidneys has a normally functioning kidney, but the kidneys differ in terms of their filtration rate. Okay, or just what it is, that how many nephron cells they've got, and how much you know filtering that kidney can do. However, there would also be somebody that has some genetic condition and there's something wrong with their kidney. So it doesn't fit on the bell curve. So everybody normally functioning, even though they're on the bell curve, you could have a healthy kidney that it doesn't have a lot of steam in it. It can't handle a lot of sodium or a lot of toxins, but it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it, and it's not in a disease state. Whereas someone else could actually have more filtration rate, more capability, but their kidney is actually damaged. It's got a genetic flaw in it, and they're in trouble. Okay. Or it could remain stable, but I mean, this is the difference between normal bell curve variation and a pathological condition. Okay. Now, so I was very interested to read when I read Spent that Jeffrey Miller was speculating that psychosis was actually part of that he was dabbling in the notion that it might be extremes on the bell curve. I don't think he has strong feelings about it, and I think it was essentially a very open-minded, very smart guy starting to think along a dimension that nobody else had really thought of before. I'm essentially certain that he's wrong. And I'm not even going to say that he's wrong because I'm not sure that that's what he believes. I think it was a speculative kind of an idea. And I think there may be little hints of truth in it. In other words, it is possible that people that are schizophrenic, for all we know, that may correlate with some open-mindedness, in some fashion. But it's not the same thing as being highly open. So the notion would be, if you're schizophrenic, you believe in all kinds of things that are actually ludicrous. Like, for example, there's little green men on Mars that are listening in on our conversation, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? And that you're seeing things that aren't there and hearing things that aren't there. That's not openness. That's a brain pathology. It's not the same thing as openness. That's not like 99th percentile openness. Now, there's a reason I say 99th percentile. The base rate for schizophrenia in the United States is about 1%. It's about 0.8%. So about 1 in 120 people evidence this problem. Those people are not, quote, just really open-minded people. That isn't what they are. They are people with a brain pathology whose openness is actually quite unremarkable before it is that they evidence a psychotic break. So in the same way, Asperger's is not normal. There's something wrong with the tracking of what we're going to call the theory of mind module, which is a device inside of people's heads. And I believe it's actually been identified or generally located in the brain at this point. There's a device in your head that allows you to track what other people are thinking and to make really good inferences about what they're likely to be thinking about. Asperger's folks, this doesn't function well at all. And autistic folks, Asperger's is, I think, a lightweight version of, I don't even know if that's true. There could be 20 different things that cause what it is that we call autism and it may be very poorly understood at this point, probably is, or it could be just a few things. And it could be that Asperger's is a lightweight version, or it could be that it's its own specific thing that is only influencing a very highly specific set of neural circuits. But I have met really high-functioning, quote, Asperger's folks, and they're real interesting to me, and they're not particularly disagreeable. Those characteristics fall along, they fall along general personality characteristics. They could be very friendly. Pleasant, easy to get along with, et cetera. So it's not the same thing as a disagreeable, stable, high conscientious, introverted guy that's just freaking brilliant at the computer, doesn't want to talk to anybody, okay, and has only a few friends and just a few interests. That is not open. Okay, that is not an Asperger's person. That's a normally functioning person with a an unusual set of characteristics on the bell curve. An Asperger's, I believe, is there is a specific likely to be genetic abnormality that is not part of the normal bell curve functioning, where essentially, quote, that kidney isn't working properly. And so doesn't mean that it's not pathological in the sense that it's not progressive. It's not getting worse. It just is what it is. It doesn't in principle hurt anything except that they can do some things that, if you're a Martian looking at them, you're like, what's the problem? Okay. But if you're a human, you're like, whoa, what did you just do? You just put your elbow in the soup of a social situation in a really weird way, buddy. But, no other animal would bother. The dog wouldn't care. The dog wouldn't think that the person's behavior was strange at all. So, good, very, very good question. And it goes wider than just the Asperger's question. It goes to the question of variances in personality, what variances look like. Like, I don't believe that there's a pathological condition called a psychopath. I don't think that there's some, quote, something wrong with that person's brain. I think that they're just, I think that's a normal bell curve distribution of an extremely disagreeable, low conscientious individual. I don't think that there's a thing that a pathological genetic flaw in something that we would call a borderline. Okay. I think that's an unstable, disagreeable person. So, and I don't think that there's a pathological flaw in something that we call narcissism. I think that's just a highly disagreeable individual. So, et cetera. In the same way that with mental retardation, there's a lot of people that are at the second percentile. There's nothing wrong with their brains. But there's people that are at the second percentile where there's some, the reason they're at the second percentile is that there's been some pathological condition. So you could have two similar looking things, but one of them would be due to pathology and another would not. Okay. So you could have had somebody with encephalitis and it could have wiped out a bunch of their brain function. Now they're at the second percentile, but that's a pathological second percentile where somebody else's is not. And, so anyway, very good question. I had one other, oh yeah, like bipolar disorder. So bipolar disorder is not it's simply somebody that is inherently very unstable. Okay, that's not just a high instability human. No, that's a very specific brain dysfunction carried along a specific genetic line that causes this bizarre, you know, occasional disruption in emotional functioning. So that's how you look at that problem, and that's how I would look at that question.
Fascinating. Well, speaking of swings in either direction emotionally, the next question is about why countries go to war.
Okay.
So, Dr. Lyle, why do countries like the United States go to war? Are we just fighting against Russia and China in every hot war, as we did in Vietnam and now in the Middle East? How do we stop the arms race?
Why would you go to war? Well, you obviously go to war because the cost-benefit analysis to somebody who's in a position of decision-making winds up convincing them that it's in their best interest. And so that, so a country, per se, doesn't go to war. Individuals decide that we're going to go to war. So there's it isn't a collective decision, because there's no such thing as a collective mind. What there is that there's decisions of specific individuals, and then you have a decision-making system, and the aggregate of a certain number of those individuals, you know, or an individual in the case of a president being able to essentially start a war if he wants to. You know, obviously, if he didn't have a lot of public support, then the Congress isn't going to be supportive, and we're going to have a problem, okay, in a Western democracy. But yeah, the United States goes to war because a certain number of those individuals, the 500 individuals or so that are essentially, you know, running the leadership of the United States federal government, there a preponderance of those individuals believe that it's in the best interest really of themselves. And what we hope is that when they are computing what's in the best interest of themselves, we hope that they are, that they're actually looking out for the best interests of the United States. And they probably are. So that doesn't mean that they're not making mistakes. They could easily make mistakes. But it is not the case that this decision-making process, which is the result of an awful lot of people, isn't going to have a lot of untoward influence in it. So don't think that there aren't people selling munitions that aren't like real interested in you know, seeing some conflict continue or be extended, you know, and they can justify their pressure on a congressman by saying, listen, we really think it's a problem. We've read what the Joint Chiefs have to say. We think these people are going to be a problem, better to crush them now, et cetera. And by the way, you know, it's just only going to cost you another $3 billion of our stuff to do it. Okay. So of course, you know, that is going on. So the decision-making people that are in the position of power to make those decisions have an awful lot of noise in their ear. And at the end of the day, you know, we elect these people because we hope that they are keeping in mind, you know, that they're wise enough to take enough counsel and to get enough of consideration of the overall cost benefit of the whole enterprise in their heads that they make good decisions. You know, sometimes they undoubtedly make good decisions. Sometimes they undoubtedly don't. So I look back, I don't know much. I mean, I don't know how you don't get involved in World War II. I think it seems to me obvious that it would be wise to not get involved in World War I. World War II looks a lot more problematic to me. I don't know how you stay out of that. I think you're in deep trouble, and I think the country's fighting for its life. Vietnam, no reason to be there. That was generally, I think, a fairly honest misunderstanding of the threat of communism around the globe. I believe that the leadership of the country conceptualized communism as essentially a contagion, and they felt like the more places it leaked and the more little third world countries that adopted it, the more dangerous and dire the United States situation would be, and we'd be surrounded. What they didn't realize is that we'd be surrounded by incompetence and a bunch of third world economies that would never get off the ground and produce anything. So they were not the threat that we thought they were. So we didn't need to be digging around in Southeast Asia trying to defend American interests there, worried about the spread of communism. But it's clear to me, based on what I've read of the actual transcripts of what we know went through LBJ's head, that he was very much worried about a contagious process. And I think a lot of those people were, and it wasn't stupid that they were, it was just incorrect in my judgment. So mistakes, why did we go to war? Cost-benefit analysis run on the people that are in charge. How do you stop it? Well, you have to understand that whenever you have something of value, people are going to want to take it. And that's the law of the jungle. And so we have unbelievably valuable things in the United States. We have amassed tremendous wealth, and therefore we have to protect our wealth and our citizens from those threats. And so you have to have a national defense. Whether or not you go to war or not depends upon the cost-benefit analysis of whether or not it's worth doing, what the threats are, et cetera. And you elect officials, and you understand that they are hopefully, making the decisions with their conscience as best they can by listening to a lot of really smart people. They're being checked by a tiered level of government that can give a president a tremendous signal that a huge number of other people think that person is wrong. And so, this is a process by which hopefully over time a country makes enough good decisions of these very difficult order that, the country survives and things work out okay. So far, so good. We're 200 plus years in and we got a good thing going.
Now, you mentioned in a earlier episode about what the future might look like.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your belief that as the world gets more economically free, and everybody essentially rises up out of poverty, and they're all having essentially enough resources to compete for mates, that the threat of war will be finally over? Or will we always do that?
No. Oh, yeah, I think so. The truth is that obviously it's in people's best interest to trade. But it's not necessarily in your best interest to trade if you don't have any knowledge or abilities or resources, and all you can get your hands on is some guns. Then your best move may be to just take. So the world is in an uncomfortable place, and it's going to be in an uncomfortable place for a long time, long after I'm gone. And that is that the westernized democracies and economies have hurtled forward so fast. It is so successful to be free and to trade that we are wealthy beyond the imagination of most of the world. Most of the world cannot imagine the extraordinary standard of living that takes place in the United States. Now, you may look at it like, hey, I don't see what's so great. I work pretty hard. I work 40 hours a week, in my air-conditioned office, but I can't go out to dinner that much. And my car is not that fancy, and I live in a pretty decent apartment, but it's not the greatest. It's like, oh my God, you're out of touch with the actual economic circumstances in the world. Economic circumstances in the world is that in a decent functioning people somewhere in the middle of Asia, in some place in Calcutta, you've got five families with 22 people living in 700 square feet. So the world is poor compared to where it's going to be. And as long as the world is poor, people are desperate. A lot of harsh things happen. And the world has the disparities of wealth and situations that give rise to a great deal of consternation and envy. And that's a problem. And so eventually, you know, eventually that's going to work out. But or if you don't blow yourselves up, or some biological warfare that can wipe out everybody on the planet. But the bottom line is that if the future continues to unfold in the way that it's unfolding, you wind up getting wealthier, 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 and wealthier, and the world gets way better. And as more people are able to become educated and to have industries and be able to trade, it becomes so worth it to not destroy and take. It becomes so worth it to just exchange. That's how everybody winds up better off. And that, you know, that's clearly, you know, the North and the South of the United States aren't going to war with each other. And Alabama and Georgia aren't going to go to war with each other, et cetera.
But Northern California and Southern California might.
Yeah, you people are taking our water. That's what I hear around here. But the point is that obviously exchange winds up being the path to freedom and prosperity. It will happen, but, you know, it's going to take time. And but we'll get there.
Fantastic. Dr. Lyle, you got time for one more question?
Got time for one more.
All right. Dr. Lyle, my husband and I are business owners, and one of our biggest challenges is finding employees who have high conscientiousness. On a previous show, Dr. Lyle, you mentioned that you find the Myers-Briggs test to be useless, does not identify whether someone is lazy, narcissistic, etc. So I'm wondering if there's another test that you recommend or some other way of assessing whether a job applicant has high or low conscientiousness.
I could do it off the cuff. There would be better ways to do this, undoubtedly, and there'd be ways that would be legal that you could sneak this in somehow. So it is a test for conscientiousness, but what we're looking for is, if you're looking for conscientiousness, there's certain things that you're going to be interested in. So you're going to be interested in kind of what their job history is, how long they've been on different jobs, et cetera. Also, you'd cross-examine them very mildly and pleasantly about, you know, how it is that they left and why. And you'd also be interested in their living circumstances. So just sort of how long have they lived, where they live, what do they like about it, you know, just sort of how, and then where did you live before that and how about before that? So in other words, I'm not sure what the legalities are, but what I'm essentially talking about here is I'm talking about the same questions that I ask criminals for 5 years when I was the psychologist for Dallas County, and so for the criminal courts. So that this was what I was doing was I was asking questions that were triangulating on major life decision and circumstances so that I could track how conscientious the individuals were. So by just a few little questions over the course of, you know, 3-4 minutes, I'm asking them about kind of who they live with and where are they there and how long they've been there and then their previous jobs and how many, you know, have they had quite a few different jobs? Do they know a lot of different stuff? Or no, I only worked at, you know, Walmart. Well, how long have you been there? 4 years. Okay, gold star for that person. Stable, same employer, you know, showed up, didn't get fired. These are huge cues to a person's conscientiousness. Also, living circumstances. Yeah, I've lived where I am for a while. How long have you been there now? You know, about 3 weeks. It's like, okay, that you just got flake on your forehead is what that is. So also, you know, how far did you get school? Oh, well, you know, 10th grade. Okay, well, no star on that person's forehead. So we want to know how far they got in school and, you know, what did they like about school and, you know, what subjects did they do well in? We're just trying to get a little feel, you know, and then, how far did you go and did you find anything else? Did you want to study more or had you kind of enough? Okay. So we're trying to get a feel for their scholastic history and what kind of student they were. And so by the time we get that, plus we got living circumstances and their stability there, plus their job history and stability there, we're in 5 minutes, you can get quite a little feel for how conscientious people are. what you're looking for is stability, 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 stability. Flakes wind up getting kicked out of places, and flakes also leave. So that's what, you know, if you had an overall general score of stability, that would be your, you know, my off the cuff, as opposed to some verified instrument that might be better. Incidentally, a super good instrument, depending upon who you're hiring and for what, would be a credit report, but I'm not so sure. I don't know that it's legal to run them, or I don't know that you can do that. But that's also another really good score to tell you kind of what's going on with a person. None of these things are perfect. No one thing will tell the whole story. But across an interview there, these are the cues that we're looking for. We're looking for anything that doesn't quite hold together and make sense and inform all the other parts of the story. So that's how I would do it.
Fantastic. And how about clothes? Yeah. What clothing when they come into the job?
Yeah, I would say all of this. I mean, certainly these would be obvious things. So their clothes, their hair, you know, how hard are they working at trying to make it look like they're clean cut and responsible? If they're not trying to work very hard at it, then we got a problem. They're probably not your best candidate. So if you're looking for conscientiousness and that's what you need, just, you know, ask these very reasonable questions. Do it in a way that appears extremely non-judgmental, okay? And just casually open it up so that the flake will tell you their flaky story, and then you know you've thrown that one out and on to the next one. That's how we do it.
Okay. Dr. Lyle, we love it. We'll talk to you next week. Have a wonderful night.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.